This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So now I'm going to get into the teaching component of this session. First, I want to start by saying, and for us at MJF, you know, we always say that all forms of violence are rooted in structural violence. That bigotry, that comment, that mistreatment at the interpersonal level is all actually grounded and rooted in systems of violence. So this is a way very much inspired by the ways in which the theory around critical race theory and a breakdown of racism occurs. We actually made a breakdown of Islamophobia that exists at these four layers. Structural, which is at, again, the policy, the laws, the institutions, the hundreds of years of that coming together, melding together, which then creates an environment for acceptance of this dehumanization. Institutional. So institution is a lot of your FBI programs. It's the Department of Homeland Security programs. You'll hear some from Mary around CVE. These are surveillance programs. So that for us is the codification via institutionalized forms of Islamophobia. And then we talk about interpersonal, which is where often people think about hate violence. They think about the bigotry. They think about the rhetoric, the speech. And then there's internalized. What are the ways that Muslim communities have unfortunately internalized these dominant messages, these dominant systems, and how we sometimes will take part in these systems against our own communities? For the purposes of today, I mean, often this is like a whole 6-month curriculum, 2 weeks curriculum. I'm not gonna cover too deeply the entire piece, but I do wanna talk about structural Islamophobia, because then that lays the groundwork for why the war on terror is built and how it gets normalized in the current moment. So in terms of what structural Islamophobia is, it is the systemic dehumanization and otherization of Muslim communities. It is a system constructed by the state. That's something I really want to underscore here, is that Islamophobia is not people's ignorance. It's not, oh, people just don't understand Islam. They don't understand Muslim communities. That actually perpetuates structural Islamophobia because it minimizes something that at the end of the day is a system constructed and held by government policies, by laws, by institutions. And I will cover that a little bit later. And it is about power. It is about domination. It is about control. It is about expanding oppressive power. That is not ignorance. That is people, systems, and those in power really constructing an institution, a form of dehumanization that is meant to really keep power and control in the hands. And in this country, it's particularly white supremacists. It's white Christian nationalists. And we also see that, particularly within structural Islamophobia right now, the narrative is often about the Muslim are others. They're a national security threat. These people are coming in attacking our culture. They're a threat to our culture, our way of being. And so you see a lot of these narratives that are really out there. I'm not gonna go too much into this right now, but again, you will see that this infrastructure, you can literally pick out laws. You can pick out decisions from the Supreme Court, citizenship making, where you can point particularly to the ways in which Islamophobia is showing up. What this produces is that it creates a fracturing of solidarity towards Muslim communities. So for many, many years, and even now, I will say a lot of times people, when you're talking about abolition of the war on terror, the one number thing I get is, but what about our safety? But what about the terrorists? But what about our national security? And I really want to name that in this room, because that is somebody who has internalized so deeply the messaging from the government and the state that truly dehumanizes Muslim communities and also folks racialized as Muslim to be like, you know what, they don't matter. Their humanity does not matter. And so I always say when we talk about narratives of public safety, national security, whose safety and whose perspective are we prioritizing, and whose dehumanization are we actually accepting in the process? Also, structural Islamophobia, and what sets it apart from other systems of oppression, is that it is the accumulation over hundreds of years. This is not something that was created post 9/11, and y'all will see when I do a brief timeline. This goes way back to literally the inception of the American colonial project. And so this, again, separates the structural from the institutional, from the interpersonal and internalized. Not going to go deep into this, but these are some of the different manifestations of how we see structural Islamophobia show up for Muslim communities. I'm going to take a minute to cover this, because what we are seeing as an organization is that movements across the world, structural Islamophobia is no longer just an American-led project. It actually never was. But movements across the world that are rooted in supremacist, nationalist, fascist ideologies that work to build societies around the dominance of one group are using Islamophobia. Some examples: the Indian state that is actually building itself upon Hindutva. They have particularly targeted Muslims in their particular country. You look at other parts of the world, China, the Uyghur Muslim communities are being targeted. If you look at France, there are Muslim minorities. They're often refugees, black and brown. And there is a deep history from France in terms of the colonization, where you see a lot of these folks that are actually part of that post-colonial world. They are using Islamophobia to, at the end of the day, really keep that supremacist ideology in place. And so some movements we see, again, white supremacists, white Christian nationalists, Zionists, Hindutva folks as well. So moving through, I'm going to really briefly cover this, because this could be a whole timeline. I also want to put a caveat out there that it's not comprehensive. There is a lot of history to this that goes even deeper. So if there are folks in the room, feel free to add to this. Feel free to talk to me. But this is a real kind of just a quick snapshot that we created. First and foremost, when we talk about Islamophobia in this country, scholars have said that up to 40% of those who were enslaved actually identified as Muslim. So from the inception of enslavement, from the inception of the buildup of racial capitalism, of anti-black racism, Islamophobia was actually a component of this and very much tied to anti-black racism, because black Muslim resistance was seen as a threat to white Christian nationalism, to white supremacists. And, you know, if we look at the history, sometimes in leftist spaces and socialist spaces, we tend to not talk about religion. But in this country, white Christian nationalism has absolutely been used to justify settler colonial violence, anti-black racism, Islamophobia. And so religion was absolutely weaponized and wielded, and Islam was seen as that sort of threat, along with also indigenous spiritual practices too. And so again, right from the inception of this country and the buildup, Islam and particularly black Muslims are seen as a threat constantly because of the ways in which there are actually traditions of resistance. Kind of growing up, kind of moving a little bit beyond the kind of borders of this, of the current America that we have, when America starts also expanding its imperialistic sort of desires, the example of the Moro Muslims, particularly this indigenous group that has resisted Spanish colonization and also American colonization, some of the kind of blueprints around CVE, around imperialism, really get tested out on the bodies of Moro Muslims. And again, these kind of white folks are coming in, some of them who actually led in the Civil War for the Confederacy, who are like, who are these people? Who are these women? Why are they resisting? We're not used to this model, which again, you see a juxtaposition, because when Afghanistan happened, the United States actually talked about, we are going to go save Muslim women over there. But back in history, there were times where they were seeing Muslim women as actually, oh, these Muslim women are fighting, they're resisting, they're not comporting to white Christian ideals of patriarchy and womanhood and so forth. So again, there's a lot happening here. There's also a lot of history of particularly South Asian Muslims who get deported out, who at the time originally were farm workers and were also supporting anti-colonial struggles back in South Asia at the same time. And the United States actually deports them. It collaborates with the British colonizers to get them hung and killed. And also you see a lot of citizenship Supreme Court cases that emerge that say, even for Arab American communities, Arab Christians are allowed to gain citizenship, but Arab Muslims are not allowed to gain citizenship. So I'm not going to go too much deep into it, because there's a lot of history here. Of course, Palestine is important, Malcolm X, Black Muslim resistance, pan-internationalism, the solidarity happening between third world anti-colonial struggles and also Black liberation movements right here. There's a big solidarity happening here, the Cold War, and then you get to 9/11. And what essentially happens is all of that history, all of that structure that has been built in, the neocons, Bush at that time, they have the social environment, they use that, they deploy that, and then they launch and coin the war on terror in 2001. And what that does is it expands the policing, the militarized state, the imperialistic state. It is what creates the buildup of Department of Homeland Security and ICE. And as we see today, we are deporters, right? We deport so many folks. It builds up the border even further, militarizes the border. It even further makes it hazy, the lines between local policing, federal policing, and intelligence. This is why you have programs like 1033, where there's military equipment that is used in parts like Afghanistan and Somalia, in Iraq, in Yemen, and then is being used here on folks that are resisting from Stop Cop City, from Ferguson, from Baltimore, and right even here in Chicago. So you also see this melding happening between global policing, intelligence, militarism, and then local work that's happening. Not going to go too much into the other pieces, but just some numbers of the impact of what we're really looking at. You know, now the new numbers are at least 3 million people that have been murdered directly or indirectly because of the war on terror just in the past 22 years. We're about to get to the 22nd anniversary this September. It has produced 38 million refugees globally. 1 in 4 refugees right now globally is a result of the war on terror that we see. It has cost over $8 trillion in terms of, and counting. And I'll say from that $8 trillion, the bulk of that money is actually going back to defense contractors. So this is not something that's even going to the people. It's taken from tax dollars from everybody here. And then it's put into the pockets of defense contractors right now. Bombing of at least 7 Muslim-majority countries. And right now, the United States is running counterterrorism operations in at least 85 countries globally. And this is why for us, when we talk about Stop Cop City and the fight to end Stop Cop City everywhere, it's so important because the global war on terror infrastructure is also a global policing, counterterrorism, militarism infrastructure as well. And it just strengthens all of these other pieces. How much more time?
You got about 9 minutes.
Perfect. I'm also just going to very briefly cover this. We have a whole module now that we run on white Christian nationalism and Islamophobia and the war on terror. I will say that the war on terror is a bipartisan project. The Democrats are also very much culpable. So this is not at all to give the Democrats a pass. But there is a unique way that the right and white Christian nationalists have used the war on terror and Islamophobia. Donald Trump started trending when he talked about banning all Muslims. That's when actually he became very much a contender. The second executive order that Donald Trump passed when he came into office was the Muslim ban. For many, many years, they had been building their bases through the anti-Sharia legislation within a lot of the right kind of held states. And now we see how that has also grown into anti-trans legislation, a lot of the fights around the school boards, school curriculums. They have an ideology of bans, book bans, ban people, ban this person. They really move with that, and banning Muslims and banning Islam was a big part of how they built a lot of their bases for many, many years. There are tons of groups that just focus on Islamophobic policy and violence that are sitting within DC. A lot of the rise of also things like the Proud Boys, these sort of vigilante groups that work in tandem with the state very much so. Former military themselves, they go out there, they'll come up with guns. Before January 6th happened, many of these folks were showing up to black churches and mosques for a very, very long time. And at that time, many Americans were just taking them as a joke. Oh, these people are not serious. Until they did January 6th. And we know that part of the thing, since this is a socialism conference and abolitionist conference, one thing we don't have on our side, and we often cannot because the war on terror infrastructure exists, is we don't have any kind of self-defense, like physical self-defense or armed groups that can go out there. The right has them, and they use them, and they weaponize them. So if the law is not enough for them to oppress our communities, they have no problem using folks who are former cops or current existing cops or former military to go out there, show up with guns to harass, monitor, and even at points kill people. Also, DeSantis is running, we know, on the Republican ticket. DeSantis is a celebrated war on terror hero. He was a general at Guantanamo Bay, where he actually presided over the torture of many men. And so we've seen the political careers of people who have fought in the war on terror, who then actually use that to get into political power and also leadership positions within political power as well. So I'm what, 8 minutes? 5 minutes? 6 minutes? All right, cool. I'm gonna do this in 6 minutes, y'all. All good. So I know I'm in a room full of, inshallah, hopefully abolitionists, but of course, very much inspired by the frameworks of Dr. Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Angela Davis, Miriam Kaba, that really talk about abolition as this long-term goal, as about the presence of something, as about what is the world we want to see. It's not just the destruction of prisons and jails. And so for us as Muslims, as Muslim organizations that came together, there was no other framework we could apply that got to the wholeness of the war on terror, and also did it in a visionary way. Because if we just focus on the death and destruction, it's a very heavy conversation. How do you take on such a huge infrastructure? But when we paired it with, again, the vision of abolitionists to say, what if we take this and rather than staying in the violence, open it as a conversation for what is it that we want that $8 trillion to go? What do we actually want to see our systems being built? That's where the framework of building communities of care, abolition of the war on terror really comes from, deeply inspired by, again, the work and vision of abolitionists. Not going to go too into it, but these are some of the priority areas of what we're calling for dismantling. Again, this is online. We have a whole platform with oral histories, with maps, everything that I'm happy to share with you all. And then in our investment side, we do want to center bodily autonomy, reproductive justice, disability justice, economic justice. And our organizations, the ones in the network, actually hold different pieces of this work to be able to carry it out. Just I'm going to very briefly cover this because this is a tool I do want to share with you all. We put out a Stop Cop City solidarity statement, but we also put out this tool right on the side of sometimes when we talk about the war on terror, people think of it as like this global foreign thing. They're like, well, how does this impact my day-to-day where in my neighborhood where we live? So we identified a couple of programs that if you want to map in your own local neighborhood, your local city, that exists. This all exists, by the way, in actually Atlanta as well, which is why we did this mapping. The 1033 program, this is military equipment that is going to be given to your local police department. So again, if you're an organizer, you're doing work around abolition, I invite you to do this mapping in your own community. The police exchanges with Israel, with IDF, this is a big one. These police exchanges that constantly happen, we've seen this in DC, we know that it happens in Atlanta as well. The FBI JTTF forces, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, are essentially FBI, local law enforcement, ICE, fusion centers all come together and collaborate. They're like building community and network themselves. If a JTTF exists, that means a fusion center exists. Fusion center is where mass amounts of data is being held about us through the SARS program. The SARS is the See Something, Say Something program that was actually put into place after 9/11 and expanded. In Chicago, there was a report that actually found that more than half of the reports that went into the SARS program were against Arab, Muslim, South Asian folks. More than 65% were against people of color. What's the danger of this? Once it goes into the SARS database, it's an FBI database, then they pass it on to JTTF to see if they want to actually incarcerate people. A lot of Stop Cop City folks, a lot of Movement for Black Lives organizers were particularly monitored using this. The dangers. Whether you did something or not, right? We know this is not about that. This is about monitoring and surveillance. That data sits there for 35 years. So just imagine that, 35 years is what we're talking about. Mass surveillance infrastructure, again, fusion centers are part of it. Chicago is a heavily surveilled city. You got a bunch of cameras everywhere. All that data is being fed into these fusion centers, and Chicago has 2 fusion centers that we have. So again, these are some things that we invite you to take if you're interested in this work, to how to make that war on terror piece really kind of, how is it showing up in your local community, in your local neighborhood? We invite you to use this tool and see if these programs are actually in operation, in existence within your cities and spaces. This is a tool, if you're an organizer who's interested in policy work, we do want to share this with you because this breaks down into 5 particular categories that we're seeing war on terror expanded. From militarism to also, right now there's a lot of conversation around hate violence, anti-Asian hate. You know, the law that was used against a lot of the Stop Cop City organizers on the ground, the domestic terrorism piece, actually was used, was put into place to quote unquote fight white supremacists. So you'll see a lot of folks in the left, or Democrats particularly, who talk about let's expand domestic terrorism framework to go after white supremacists. And they will say it's to actually protect people of color. In reality, through the murder of Tort, we know that they are actually using these laws often to come after movements and communities of color. So we really talk to our folks who do gender justice or anti-hate violence work that please do not let the expansion of domestic terrorism laws happen, because they will be used right back against our communities and our movements. So awesome. With that, that was our like teaching. And now I'm going to pass it to my amazing colleague, Mary, to talk about a local campaign in Chicago that happened.
Thanks, Darakshan. That was a lot of knowledge that you laid on us. Thank you so much. I love the way you set that all up. And I guess what I'll be able to do is just share with you all about a grassroots campaign that went from like 2015 to 2020. Share with you kind of some of the roadblocks and some of the complexities of organizing around these war on terror frameworks. There's a lot of layers of difficulty, but also some amazing things. So this work started, this is sort of a list of some of the groups that were involved. I work at American Friends Service Committee, I should say that, and direct the Chicago Peace Building Program. But a lot of these other organizations were all part of this, and as much as we could, we tried to be Muslim-led, so Arab American Action Network was an important partner, CARE Chicago, and then also Muslim folks who were unaffiliated but found out by coming to some of our teach-ins, really started to take leadership, lead trainings, do that kind of work as well. But from the beginning, it was kind of a Muslim-led, but with allies, kind of intergenerational, multiracial sort of coalition. I want to just ground people in what CVE is. So I want to see... Raise your hand if you've ever been outraged by U.S. or Western foreign policy. Anybody? All right. Raise your hand if you've ever become involved in activism in your community or social issues. Yes. Have you ever grown facial hair? All right. Yeah. How about, have you ever been at a transitional time in your life? Right. Okay. So you might have guessed, but if you raise your hand for any of those things, then you are, congratulations. You're potentially seen as a violent extremist by the U.S. government. And it's true. These are some of the very specious ways that the Department of Homeland Security countering violent extremism programs, these are that's kind of part of the rubric that they use to suspect that somebody might be vulnerable to radicalism is the term that they use, or potential violent extremist. And so what happens is that some of the indicators are also very outwardly targeted at the Muslim community. So if you dress in outwardly religious garb, if you go to a majority Muslim, if you travel to a majority Muslim country, if you visit a mosque, I mean, all of these things that are constitutionally protected rights can potentially be indicators to the U.S. government. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. So CVE started in, and I'll give you a whole timeline, because one of the roadblocks that I'll identify like immediately is that because they're surveillance programs, they're really hard to pin down. They're really hard to find information about. They're really hard to keep track of, because they keep changing the name of them. They rebrand them like all the time. As soon as somebody sort of figures out and starts analyzing something like CVE, then they'll rebrand it. So I'll share some of those, that journey with you. But that becomes a really difficult thing. The other thing is, Darakshan shared so well, is that the war on terror framework is so insidious, right? It's very hidden, and it's very much become a normalized way of our way of life. I mean, these things happened, as Darakshan showed in the timeline, way before 9/11. But since 9/11, there have been so many policies and laws that have been put into place that we just accept, right? So this sort of invisibility of CVE was one of the roadblocks. And so the way CVE, the whole, because I'm just going to call it that from the beginning, because even though it's rebranded, it's essentially the same idea. These are big grants that are given through the Department of Homeland Security. They are given to mostly law enforcement, but also because the way that this works is they're trying to get trusted community members to identify, to use this specious rubric of these indicators and identify people who might be vulnerable to radicalism, and then they become involved in law enforcement. So some of these trusted community members could be imams, could be teachers, could be mental health workers, could be librarians. So this is what they're trying to do, is basically this again sows all kinds of mistrust within communities too. If you think that your therapist might be reporting on you, or your teacher, or whatever, and this is based on a program in the UK called Prevent. I don't know if folks have heard about it, but they have like a whole decade before us to show that this has been a really harmful project. So this was again brought in during Obama. It was supposed to be like a softer approach to counterterrorism. And it launched in 2014. Our coalition work started around 2015. The Center for New Community, Kalia Abiad, came in and did a train, kind of gave us all a grounding in what CVE was. And we started to do our work of just trying to figure out where is it in Chicago? Where was it happening? At the time, the FBI had created this kind of video, like really 90s looking video game. It was supposed to be really fancy, but it's called Don't Be a Puppet, and you can Google that and find it online. But it was for high school students to sort of like learn how to like spy on their the students that they were in school with, their peers, to figure out if they might be vulnerable to radicalism. And so we were like getting a wind that they were kind of looking at teachers, and so we started to organize teachers, which I'll tell you about in a second. But along the way, in this sort of timeline, a national sort of Stop CVE coalition started to come together as well. It was guided by the Muslim Justice League in Boston and Fatima Ahmad. Like, incredible work. This coalition still is going strong, and we also connect with the folks in the UK who've done work against Prevent for many years. So there was that piece too, and there was a win around 2017 for that national coalition. Because we were raising so much ruckus about this, that groups started to say, "No way, I'm not gonna accept this," and they would put pressure on various government agencies, like in LA or else in North Carolina, a university, to like actually give back the $2 million grant that they got from the DHS for these programs. In 2019, we had a little victory here to shut down a statewide program, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. But then they start, again, just rebranding these things. In 2020, CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, became rebranded, and I'm going to write it, I wrote it down. It's TVTP, which is Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention, TVTP. And then the next year, they rebranded it again, and now it's Center for Prevention, Programs, and Partnerships, which kind of, again, it sounds so innocuous. You're like, what's wrong with that, right? It sounds great. But the partnerships really gets at, again, the part that I think is the scariest is that they're really trying to work with folks in the community to be part of, surveilling their own community. And again, this is just, Darakshan laid it out so well. But this is obviously part of the War on Terror framework, and part of my organization's desire to be part of this work was that we had done anti-war work for so many years, very focused on the war on terror, but we saw that this was a clear example of these frameworks, this structure being applied to local communities, and so we really wanted to be part of bringing that to light. So I'm just going to share a few of the strategies that we use locally, and again, like, kind of try to surface the roadblocks. And we want to make this quick because we know you all have some examples probably in your own communities. We'd love to hear the kind of organizing people are doing locally as well. But in AFS, in Chicago with the Stop CVE Coalition, we started organizing teachers, and I should have put in here also social workers, because again, we had a clue that they were trying to maybe work with teachers or mental health workers to start to, basically spy on people. And so we got into this great partnership with the University of Illinois Chicago Department of Education, and really brilliant professor there, Nicole Wynn, who is a fantastic researcher. And so we started through connections with Teachers for Social Justice here in Chicago, we did a big, like, 8-week, like, teach-in kind of thing. And a lot of people came to that were teachers, and they were like, hey, I really want to know about this. And from there, we basically trained maybe, like, 20 people who were able to kind of keep doing these teach-ins across the city. And we trained hundreds of teachers over the 5 years in various settings, sometimes within school settings. We actually, because we also worked with University of Illinois Chicago, we were able to get professional development credits for people to show up to these things. And so, you know, we were able to really be able to, I think, make a positive impact in with teachers in classrooms. Because the other thing is that you have to remember this is right in the period where there was a big focus on Islamophobia because of the harsh rhetoric and the policies of the Trump campaign or the Trump administration with the Muslim ban. So people kind of really wanted to know about Islamophobia and wanted to understand how to be a good ally. And so we were able to, I think, kind of do both things at once. So I think we had a positive impact with the hundreds of teachers that we were able to train. We also developed two, and I'm going to give you some links for this, but we developed some pretty rad curriculum, I must say, Countering Anti-Muslim Racism in Schools. It's a 6th through 12th grade curriculum, and also Teaching the Legacy of 9/11, which is just like a lesson plan, like a one-off lesson plan, but it's for grades 1 through 12. There's different, you know, obviously changes in each grade year, but and they're aligned to the Common Core. So if there are any teachers in the room, you might be interested. But this was, you know, another way that we're trying to, this was like our backdoor way to be talking about CVE, is like, hey, learn how to be a good ally, learn about Islamophobia, and then this is like a structural way that it's applied. Research was another strategy that we used, and again, we had the benefit of Dr. Nicole Wynn's amazing research. Nicole uncovered a lot of stuff. One of the things we found out was that University of Illinois Chicago was training mental health workers in, you know, being able to, like, social workers would come in, get their professional development grants or credits from UIC, but they were basically being taught to use these specious indicators. And we disrupted one of those meetings, and it was full of FBI folks. There were like 5 FBI guys in the room with the social workers. So we were constantly trying to make connections with sort of radical social workers on that campus. But there's, again, this is where it becomes really a barrier because of people being afraid. You know, they hear there's 5 FBI folks in the room during this demonstration. People got arrested. People become kind of afraid. It has a chilling effect. But Nicole helped us produce 2 reports. One is called Suspected and Surveilled, and the other one is Criminalizing Mental Health. And when we put out the Suspected and Surveilled thing, it really unveiled where the Department of Homeland Security grants in Chicago were, which is at a thing called ICJA, which was the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority. So, and again, like a really innocuous, like, what even is that? But it is a governmental agency. They had the grant, and what they were doing, and again, this shows you how they try to hide everything, they were doing bystander intervention trainings. So the head of this grant, who worked at ICJA, was going around the state of Illinois and basically going to libraries and saying, hey, you know, and again, using the idea of Islamophobia and the sort of current climate of hate during the Trump administration, saying, hey, don't you want to make sure that we understand how to train community members to, you know, help each other and make sure that there's no hate? And librarians would say sure, but then they would go in and basically give a training on how to identify potential violent extremists. It wasn't like, you know, how to stop somebody, how to help somebody if there's a racist rant going on. It was this other thing. So we shone a light on that. We published this report. We did some media around it, and this was our little victory, was that they basically shut down that program. The person who we named in the report resigned. I think he was, you know, he was a Muslim folk, and in the community, I think he was, it was very controversial, so I think he didn't want his name associated with that. He was also running for office. So I think it was kind of like a name and shame sort of situation. But, you know, again, look, just unearthing the roadblocks, we know that they've continued this work and other things. So it just goes more underground. They rename it. They put it in a different agency. So we were able to shut down this program and shine some light on it. But we know that we didn't stop CVE-type programs in Chicago. I guess another sort of one of the complexities is that there is a lot of different viewpoints on whether or not to participate in CVE within the Muslim community. Not everybody's all, on board that this is a dangerous thing. I mean, just as their Drakshan surfaced, you know, people are like, yeah, but what about us? We want to keep safe. So I think that seemed very generational to me, and I know folks in the room who are of the Muslim community can probably give us more of a download on what this is, but that was definitely attention too, and I think that partially led to the resignation of the person from ICJ. But the last strategy I'll share with you is that we started to do a lot of cultural organizing. I think feeling that necessity for the communities of care that Drakshan kind of lifted up, we really wanted to, as we were, you know, gathering more and more people into our coalition, you know, create friendships and community, and we really started to do that with food, with the usual things that you do in organizing meetings, but we started to organize around the arts too, and we had a big month-long exhibit at the P.O. Box Collective in Rogers Park, which is a cool place, and where Drakshan's is doing some work now too, and that invited artists, any Muslim artists who wanted to share their work, especially around state violence. We curated the show together. We had a co-curatorial committee, and then we had it was great because it was a place that gave us a whole month to stage a ton of teach-ins, a ton of cultural events. We had a whole DJ event with music and everything. But this kind of work, I think, is the balance to the heaviness of the difficulty of these surveillance programs that really do tear communities apart. We want to bring communities together. So I'll leave it there, I think. Oh, and just some resources. If folks want to look at the National Stop CVE website or the curriculums I was letting you know about. And that's it.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.